The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll start with an article from The Past is Prologue, titled Floating on Air by Michael Callahan. A century on, the country's most beloved Thanksgiving spectacle reaches new heights. That first parade, held on a relatively mild Thanksgiving day in 1924, was extolled as a marathon of mirth in splashy newspaper ads. It was actually more akin to a modest church carnival on wheels, comprising a few marching bands, some clowns, some Mother Goose-themed floats, and a small menagerie of animals on loan from Manhattan's Central Park Zoo that occasionally terrified onlooking children with their howls and growls. The procession managed to trudge a staggering 6 miles from 145th Street all the way down to Herald Square to its final destination, R.H. Macy and Company, America's largest department store. Despite its modest offerings, the parade still drew a crowd by the time Santa, pulling up the rear, descended from his sleigh and climbed a ladder to sit on an ornate gold throne above the store's brand new entrance on 34th Street. An estimated 10,000 people were there to cheer him on. It was a crowning achievement in more ways than one. Macy's was celebrating its just-completed expansion to 1 million square feet of retail space, which now gobbled up an entire city block from Broadway to 7th Avenue. With a blare of his shiny trumpet, Kris Kringle sounded the call for the Macy's windows to reveal their holiday displays, which the store had branded the Fair Frolics of Wondertown. Spectators rushed to the windows, reveling in the dancing marionettes behind the glass. The parade merited barely a mention in the next day's papers, but based on the crowd size, Macy's thought it had a hit on its hands, soon placing ads declaring that we did not dare to dream its success would be so great. It was the birth of a new annual tradition that would become as much a part of Thanksgiving as turkey, pumpkin pie, or football. While Macy's wasn't the nation's first Thanksgiving Day spectacle, the honor goes to Philadelphia's Gimbel's Parade, launched 4 years earlier. Over time, it set the standard for what an American parade could be. Whether you have stood amid the crushing throng, jumping up and down to gawk at a giant Popeye, or simply watched the affair while pleasantly sinking into your sofa, the enrapturing spell of the Macy's Parade, the undeniable pull of its sheer, overwhelming Americanness, never quite fades. Macy's marketing established the parade as a clever, homespun tradition to remind people to start buying Christmas gifts. Two factors came to cement its status as communal annual ritual for the nation. The first was the birth of the television, which, starting in 1948, beamed the extravaganza into living rooms nationwide. The other would become the crown jewel of the parade's unabashedly hokey pageantry, its collection of majestic balloons, beginning with a two-story Felix the Cat in 1927. The balloons got ever bigger and more elaborate every year. An inflated army of Snoopies, Underdogs, Bullwinkles, and Yogi Bears lazily bobbing their ways between skyscrapers, each onlooker's face toward skyward in worship. In the early years, the balloons were released into the air afterward, with a return address provided and a reward of as high as $100 offered for each one's return. Locating and retrieving the errant deflated behemoths became a treasure hunt for the area thrill chasers. The tradition lasted until 1932, when 22-year-old student aviator Annette Gibson attempted to catch the 60-foot-long balloon of Tomcat with her small aircraft, entangling a wing and sending her plane and plunging into a tailspin over Jamaica, Queens. Gibson's flying instructor took over the controls and landed them safely. Over the decades, the parade has evolved into a massive panorama. In 1948, there were 17 floats, 6 balloons, and a few bands. This year's parade will include 27 floats, a dozen marching bands from across the country, more than 60 balloons, 5 to 7 Broadway numbers, various dance and cheer routines, and the occasional chart-topper singer, and of course, those legendary leggy Radio City Rockettes, a fixture since 1958. Last year, more than 28 million people viewed at home, the largest audience ever. For them, the Macy's Parade is far more than a procession of glittery floats and chlorine kick lines. Creating a mere spectacle is one thing, but creating a shared sense of national belonging, a piercing pride in being an American, in an era marked by tragic division, is a feat for the ages. When you go to the parade, says historian Doug Matthews, author of the 2022 book Why We Love Parades, Their History and Enduring Appeal, you unconsciously enter a space that's sacred. A miracle on 34th Street, indeed. A Most Musical Motorcade by Chris Klimek. Some of the brassiest acts to grace the event over six tuneful decades. The Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade was a generational tradition when the organizers decided to dial up the excitement by adding star performers to the event in the late 1950s. But it wasn't easy to stage a genuine concert on the moving vehicle in cold weather during a live television broadcast. So, starting in 1964, the performers would often lip-sync to a playback of music they recorded earlier. Here are some of the most memorable musical acts that have gotten America tapping our toes before turkey time. 1958, Benny Goodman and his sextet. The King of Swing, who appeared in the 1934 and 1937 parades as a non-performing celebrity guest, finally got to cook this year on the standard The World is Waiting for the Sunshine. 1973, George Jones and Timmy Wynette. The volatile but prolific music country music power couple performed We're Gonna Hold On, the title track from the second album of duets they released that year. They would divorce in 1975. 1980. If ever a song was designed to be performed atop a festive, slow-moving barge making its way south down a Manhattan thoroughfare, it's the irrepressibly welcoming R&B disco anthem We Are Family, released just 22 months earlier, but already a classic. 1996, Bo Diddley. The Captain and Tennille, Vanessa Williams, and the cast of Sesame Street were there too, but only the then 67-year-old creator of the Bo Diddley beat ventured a self-diagnosis, performing his new single, Bo Diddley is Crazy, atop the Tom Turkey float. Next, we'll move on to an article titled The Fruit Detective by Mark Shapiro. Renaissance paintings, medieval archives, cloistered orchards. How one Italian scientist is uncovering secrets that could help combat a growing agricultural crisis. When Isabella Dalla Ragione assesses a Renaissance painting, she doesn't immediately notice the brush strokes or the magnificence of the imagery. The first thing she notices is the fruit. On a spring day earlier this year, I stride with Dalla Ragione into the National Gallery of Umbria, in a 14th century stone castle built atop the hillside city of Perugia. Umbria, a region in central Italy next to Tuscany, is known more for its lush green spaces, hillside cities, and Etruscan and Roman ruins than for its art. But the painters of Renaissance Italy traveled between regions, and some of the works on display in Perugia are as awe-inspiring as those in Florence. We breeze through room after room, passing a blur of masterworks by the likes of Gentile da Fabriano and Benozzo Gozzoli. Under Dalla Ragione stops before a radiant painting that fills an entire room of its own. The arresting work is by Piero della Francesca, an artistic giant of the 14th century. It shows the Madonna, wrapped in a deep blue robe, cradling a toe-headed baby Jesus. But Dalla Ragione points me to what looks like a small bunch of translucent marbles in Jesus' tiny hand, cherries. They're pale red with a white tint. Aquiola cherries, a variety that has almost disappeared in Italy, but back then was quite common. Their juice was seen as symbolic of Christ's blood. The vaulted ceiling, the spiritual imagery, the murmurs and footfalls of other museum goers give the scene a sacred feeling. Before we can linger, Dalla Ragione, at 67, fast-talking and spirited, with chic glasses and stylishly short gray hair, rushes past the painting and on to somewhere else. Come on, let's go. There's another one you must see, she insists as we take off down another long corridor. She steers us to one more Madonna with Child, the center of an altarpiece painted by Bernardino de Beto, better known as Pintoriccio, in 1495 or 1496. It is all glimmering blues and reds and golds. Look there, she exclaims, pointing to the bottom of the painting. At the Madonna's feet, just off the gold hem of her azure robe, are three gnarly-looking apples, oddly shaped varieties you'd never see in a market today. For most viewers, that would be an afterthought. For Dalla Ragione, the apples, including a variety known in the fruit science lexicon as apipiccola, represent a key to restoring Italy's disappearing fruit agriculture, with characteristics not found in today's apples. Crunchy and tart, they are capable of being stored at room temperature for about 7 months and maintain their best qualities outside the fridge. And those ungainly apples are just one variety among scores of others that Dalla Ragione, who is among Italy's foremost experts on tree fruits, has identified as being widely cultivated in the 16th century and largely gone by the 21st, as genetic diversity among all of Italy's major fruit trees continues to plunge. In fact, Dalla Ragione has spent more than a decade scouring the masterpieces of 15th and 16th century art for answers to one of the great questions of Italian agriculture. What happened to the boisterous selection of fruits that, for centuries, were a celebrated part of Italian cuisine and culture? Slowly and indefatigably, she has been rediscovering those fruits, first in archives and paintings, and then, incredibly, in small forgotten plots across Italy. Her nonprofit, Archaeologica Arborea, is helping farmers and governments around the world preserve and even bring back into cultivation all manner of forgotten fruits. In the process, Dalla Ragione has become a globally renowned fruit detective by recognizing in her country's Renaissance artworks not only exceptional examples of cultural patrimony, but also hidden messages from a bygone era of genetic abundance that can offer clues about how to recover what was seemingly lost. 6 centuries ago, Italy boasted hundreds of varieties for every fruit, each adapted to specific ecological niches. Apple, pear, and cherry varieties across Umbria were different in subtle and not-so-subtle ways, from Venetian, Florentine, or Piedmontese varieties. At the turn of the 20th century, the country was home to at least 1,000 pear varieties, according to Dalla Ragione. Today, Italy is one of Europe's foremost producers of pears, yet for both pears and apples, a mere 4 varieties each now compose more than 70% of the country's production, compared with the hundreds of varieties that were common a century ago. A 2020 Atlas of Biodiversity, commissioned by the Ministry of Agriculture, to which Dalla Ragione contributed, documents how dozens, if not hundreds of varieties of peaches, grapes, cherries, and apricots once cultivated in Italy's many regions have shrunk to a handful of uniform varieties for each fruit nationwide. The loss of those varieties isn't just a question of lost deliciousness. It also means that we've lost centuries of adaptability encoded into the genes of the fruits of yesteryear. According to Mario Marino, an agronomist working with the Climate Change Division of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, who serves on the Board of Advisors for Archaeological Arborea, rediscovering the descendants of those old fruits will be crucial for Italy's ability to withstand the unpredictable and increasingly dramatic effects of climate change. One of the few places where you can find some of these ancient fruits is 35 miles from the city of Perugia, high in the hills above the Tiber River, in the orchard surrounding Dalla Ragione's family home. It takes some grinding of the gears and my rented Fiat to get up the dirt road leading to it. 8 centuries ago, the house was a Romanesque stone church. In the 1940s, the church became a monastery. The living quarters now house Dalla Ragione's kitchen and workspace. From a window, you can see the orchard, covering about 7.5 acres that undulates softly down toward the river. It's thick with more than 600 trees and plants, encompassing 150 varieties. The orchard boasts 43 varieties of pear alone. Dalla Ragione's desk, really a 6-foot-long wooden slab, is piled with books and research materials, including a 600-year-old book about agriculture, centuries-old reports by municipal authorities on the fates of various crops, and oversized pictorial books of Renaissance masters. Here's a book on Bellini, she exclaims, flipping to a page that includes the famous painting often called Madonna col Bambino, or sometimes called Madonna della Pera, Mother with Child, or Madonna of the Pear. But it's not a pear, it's an apple. She's often finding such mistakes. Dalla Ragione identifies it as a cow nose apple, quite common 600 years ago, extremely rare today, and so named because its shape recalls an elongated snout. The painting's mistake comes almost certainly did not originate with Giovanni Bellini, but rather with later art historians, likely seeking to distinguish between the many Madonna with Child paintings of the time. Dalla Ragione's deepest connection to this land is through her father, Livio Dalla Ragione, born in Tuscany in 1922 and raised down the road from here in the medieval village of Città del Castello. After fighting in these hills as a partisan against the fascist Mussolini government and then against the Nazis during the German occupation of Italy, he became part of the Art Materica movement centered in Rome that favored using wood, textiles, and other tactile ingredients for making art. He moved back to Umbria in 1960, bought the former monastery, and turned it into a home for his family. While teaching art at a local university, Livio began researching the implements and practices of rural life in the region, which were already beginning to disappear as industrial farms replaced local farmers, and those displaced farmers abandoned country life and moved to the cities. Livio was a pioneer of what is now a dynamic rural farm and food movement in Italy, and he planted this precious family orchard with local varieties that he'd seen farmers abandon. He also founded a folk art museum that still operates in Città di Castello. Dalla Ragione received her undergraduate degree in agronomy from the University of Perugia, while also studying theater and acting with various troupes. She even took courses with a teacher from a renowned clown school in Paris. She describes living two lives during the 1980s, one in theaters as a performer, the other in the fields as an agronomist. At the time, the rise of industrial-scale farming in Italy and around the world was driving a rapid decline in crop diversity, as generic seeds that could be grown over vast areas replaced those adapted to specific regions. Local fruit varieties disappeared from the fields and the market. Thousands of local breeders were bought out or were unable to compete. By her early 30s, Dalla Ragione recognized her true passion. I had to decide whether to be a real actress and go all around the world like an actress without roots. Instead, I saw I needed my roots, my territory, my stories, and I left theater and focused my life on the fruit trees. At the beginning, she followed her father around as he interviewed local farmers about lost and disappearing fruit varieties. It was like an adventure for me, a little bit of a divertissement, she recalls. But nobody in those days talked about biodiversity or genetic erosion. In 1989, when she was 32, she and her father founded Archaeological Arborea, the organization that would serve as an umbrella for their largely self-funded research into those lost species. Each still had a full-time job. Livio as a teacher, Isabella as an agronomist consulting with nearby regions on their biodiversity and agroecology strategies. Livio had combined his interests in art and farming into a kind of improvised anthropology, and Dalla Ragione says it was her father who inspired the multidisciplinary approach she pursues today, combining the tree sciences with art history, archival detective work, and even the storytelling she learned from theater, which she says helps communicate her findings to students, researchers, and the public. After her father died in 2007, she says, I continued his research, but I gave it a more scientific dimension. She also continued working as an agronomist on nationwide biodiversity conservation strategies, which included searching out the descendants of old regional fruit varieties. In 2006, her research led her to a palazzo, barely 10 miles from her home, that once housed the Bufalini family, major Umbrian landowners in the 16th century. There, in a room filled with boxes of old paper records off of the second floor loggia or balcony, Dalla Ragione pored through inventories of crops owed to the family by their tenant farmers, gardeners' reports, records of centuries-old real estate deals, and other documents, many of them in ornate 16th-century handwriting. One inventory listed some 65 varieties of fruits that the Bufalinis grew 600 years ago, including more than two dozen varieties of pears and apples, with such inviting names as Pera del Duca del Cortana, a pear named after the Duke of Cortana, Emile Incarnate di Sestino, an apple named for its inward redness. It was a goldmine of names and descriptions of plants and trees. But Dalla Ragione soon found that digging through centuries-old figures on a page could only get her so far. Then she had a revelation that quickened her hunt for ancient fruit trees. Inside the palazzo, she'd regularly pass stone walls hung with paintings evoking battles, religious iconography, and mythical scenes. One day, she stopped and looked more carefully at the ceiling in the Prometheus room, so-called because it features a 16th-century fresco by Cristofano Gerardi of Prometheus delivering fire to humans. Now she noticed for the first time that the pears and apples and plums and other fruits she had been reading about in the archives upstairs were scattered throughout the scene above her head. At this moment, I understood the circle of connection between the documents, the frescoes, and the real fruits, she says. I put together that art was at the same period of time as the documents. For me, it was an incredible connection. Fruits, when she started looking at paintings, were everywhere. She realized that paintings were not just art. They were evidence, and not only evidence of fruit from hundreds of years ago. There were also evidence that the fruits growing in her own orchard, the elongated pear, the snub-nosed apple, the yellowish-green plum, were probably descendants of those rendered in the frescoes and paintings she encountered. She also came to understand how lucky she was to be working in Italy, in many ways the center of Renaissance painting. Before the 15th century, almost all European artwork was focused on a mythical or religious imagery. But in a shift away from the formal and thematic rigidity of the medieval period, many artists, often immersed in their own rural societies, began to paint nature and its bounty with increasingly devoted precision. Even more important, Dalla Ragione says, fruits often carried symbolic meaning. Cherries, the blood of Christ, pears, the symbol of paradise after death, and so on. Painters needed to be precise in their renderings so that messages from the paintings had to arrive to everybody, rich and poor alike. That lifelike precision meant that Dalla Ragione can tell, by the placement of a fruit's stem, or its shape, or the colors of its skin, not only the species of fruit, but also the variety. That is, not only the difference between an apple and pear, but the difference between one kind of apple or pear and another. Later artistic movements that prized imagination over figurative accuracy don't offer remotely the same degree of precision. In the years since her Eureka moment at the Palazzo Bufalini, Dalla Ragione has turned Archaeological Arborea into a nonprofit research and educational foundation to support her scientific research documenting fruit traits and the variety of environmental stresses trees can withstand, or cannot. In addition, Archaeological Arborea now accepts grants from philanthropists, mostly in Italy and the United States, and it works with scientific organizations like the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization and the University of Perugia. In 2017, Dalla Ragione obtained a PhD in biodiversity from the University of Perugia. For her doctoral thesis, she analyzed the genomes of hundreds of pear varieties, which led to a radical discovery. Older pears, dating back to the 15th century and earlier, have many more alleles, meaning more genetic diversity, than the 21st century varieties. That diversity, says Lorenzo Raghi, a researcher in agricultural genetics and biotechnologies at the University of Perugia, can translate into greater capacity to adapt to different conditions. This genetic diversity also meant that there were huge differences among the fruit themselves, even those from the same roots. One year, the trees would produce fruits of one color, and the next year, another color, Dalla Ragione says. It also gave these varieties the capacity to adapt to shifting conditions generation after generation. They may not produce as much per tree as modern varieties, but their traits help them survive new pests and changing weather conditions, meaning they produce fruit more steadily over decades and even centuries. Those diverse traits are on a brilliant display in the piles of multicolored and idiosyncratically shaped pears and apples inside what was once the nave of the 13th century home church that is now Dalla Ragione's home. She calls the room her apple chapel because it's cold and dry enough to store fruits from her orchard for up to a year without refrigeration. Many of them are smaller than the fruits we're accustomed to, slightly gnarled and misshapen, with occasional oblongs that we're used to as circles. Some taste tartar, others very sweet, and several are quite mushy. She usually turns them into jams or vinegars for her friends. But they are recognizable as pears and apples, the relatives of those we commonly encounter today. Without chemical boosters, however, many modern varieties may have limited response to pests or weeds or diseases, says Rocky. The older fruits may not be as uniform or big as those today, he says, but they were selected by humans and the environment to survive, and conserving those diverse characteristics is a critically important part of Dalla Ragione's work. The importance of agricultural biodiversity, Dalla Ragione says, can be explained with a very human metaphor, language. She likens biodiversity on a farm to expanding a vocabulary. Conventional agriculture, with its limited genetic range, relies on a narrow vocabulary. Industrial agriculture created a few varieties that are very productive in very precise conditions, with lots of chemicals and a lot of water. The new varieties may be bigger and have more consistent color, but they have very few genes, few words. Their genetic patrimony is very simple. If you present the right question, they can answer, because maybe they have 4 or 5 or maybe 10 words. But if you present other questions, like drought or climate change or other situations, they have no words to answer. They can't answer because they do not have enough genetic variability inside to answer those questions. Old varieties have a big vocabulary. They have many words to answer these new questions. In order to make use of those genetic answers, however, they need to be rediscovered not only in paintings or musty feudal inventories, but also in the ground. Biodiversity is dynamic. It cannot be preserved like an object, like a piece of furniture, Dalla Ragione says one afternoon as we drive the winding country roads of Umbria in search of fruit. You can't restore an ecosystem by putting seeds in a refrigerator. So we will pause the article there and finish that next time. So we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time to finish up that article. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is written with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.